Hi there, welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I just had the pleasure of talking with Miriam Soss about her book, Experimental Arts in Postwar Japan, Moments of Encounter, Engagement, and Imagined Return, that came out with the Harvard University Asia Center in 2011. Now, this is a book that looks at moments in the arts in Japan from the 1960s to the 1980s, the early 1980s, focusing, though, on the 60s and 70s. It's a book that spans experimental arts that range from experimental theater to film, video, photography, various forms of text, poems, etc., etc. Now, even if, though, you're not a scholar of modern Japanese history or literature or the arts, even if you're not a scholar of comparative literature or even consider yourself terribly interested in the experimental arts in modernity, this is a book that you can get a lot out of. The reason for that is that the kinds of context that Soss is writing about explore themes that are of potentially very, very wide relevance to those of us working in or interested in any number of fields, the kinds of themes that are dealt with in the texts that she's looking at, in the people that she's looking at and their work, range from the idea of the fragment, the relationship between time and language, the nature of identity and the collaborative, etc., etc. It's really wide-ranging kinds of themes here that just have, frankly, given me a lot of food for thought, and I enjoyed the book tremendously. We had a great time talking about it, and I hope you enjoy. Hi, Miriam.
Hi.
We're here today to talk with Miriam Soss about her recent book, Experimental Arts in Postwar Japan, Moments of Encounter, Engagement, and Imagined Return. Now, this was a fascinating book for me to read. I work on material that's completely removed, you would think, from the setting of this book, 1960s and 1970s, Japan, experimental arts. And yet there's so much in here that I think speaks so much more broadly to anybody interested in the humanities, the arts, and not just in Japan and not just in East Asia. So, Miriam, thank you so much for talking with us about it today, and I'm really looking forward to talking with you.
Well, thank you so much for interviewing me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. So, Miriam, could you start us off a little by just saying a little bit about what brought you into the study of Japan and modern Japan in particular in the first place? How did you get into this field?
Well, there are always coincidences when you start doing something, but I was an undergraduate at Harvard, and there was a teacher named Tazuko Monane, who was a really excellent teacher of Japanese. And she was just known throughout the undergraduate population as being such an amazing teacher with such an amazing program. And I didn't at that time really have any connection with Japan. I had never been there. I knew nothing about it. But in my literature classes, I was doing more Western literature, like French and English literature and the literature concentration. And this is probably part of the historical development of comparative literature overall as a field, is that there had started to be a really intense awareness that the field of comparative literature might start to be called the field of comparative European literatures, the way it was being practiced. Like there was very little attention to East Asian literatures, to literatures of other places. And at the same time, trends in multiculturalism and postcolonial studies and things like that were coming up. So there was kind of like this question being asked in my Western literary studies, well, what would happen to these ideas that we're trying to study cross-culturally if we brought in, pick an example, you know, something else. But if we brought in an Asian literature into this conversation, what would happen to the conversation? And so I didn't know which non-Western literature to study, but everyone knew that the Japanese program was so fabulous. So I began to study Japanese that way and to travel to Japan. And then there was something called the Japan-America Student Conference that is a really great program I recommend to anyone listening or to their undergrads as a place where Japanese and American students run a kind of seminar together and explore topics they're interested in. So just gradually, little by little, not to mention that it was the bubble period in Japan, so there was a really good good economics for getting fellowships to go to Japan and stuff like that. although there weren't, most of the, my classmates were trying to study words like keizai masatsu, like economic friction, rather than, wanting to read Akutagawa Ryunosuke. But the teachers had big minds and had us read Akutagawa also. And so that was kind of like my gradual entry into Japanese studies.
It's so interesting how many people that I speak with, myself included, got into East Asian studies in some respect and, you know, for to study some field as a result of a language program or language teachers. So this is a little plug for the funding of language programs far and wide, because they really do help shape and sort of feed interest in the development of a field.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was also a program called the College Women's Association of Japan, where a bunch of educated Japanese women got together and decided they wanted to fund some feminist scholars to study Japan comparatively, like in a feminist or gender studies or sexuality studies kind of vein. And at the time, I was pretty young and I had no idea what I was really going to study, but that sounded like a good idea. So that was part of how I was able to go over to Japan for my first year of study there.
That's great.
So if you think about that, like that, I had no idea where I was heading with this, but there was this group of people with a big vision that were creating structures and institutions to allow things like this to happen.
Now, even though you say you started off with not a clear sense of where exactly you were going, there's a really clear connection between this project that we're going to talk about for the rest of our time today and your previous work. Now, you mentioned at the beginning of the book that this project started out as an exploration of the relation between performance and memory in Japanese in Japanese surrealism, right? Previous work on surrealism. So this work looks at performance in experimental theater of the 60s and 70s, but this grows out of your previous work in Fault Lines, Cultural Memory and Japanese Surrealism. Okay, so can you talk a little bit about the transition between your previous work on surrealism and how you came from that subject to the current project that this book explores today?
Yeah, some people sometimes talk to me about that, the way in which, you know, like, wait, you were going to be a specialist on the 20s and 30s. You were going to be like a Taisho, early Showa person. And now you're studying post-war and what happened there? You know, we lost you in the Taisho period or something like that. And maybe I'll be going back eventually. But in the epilogue to my last book, I wrote about Butoh dance. And there was a very formative experience that happened to me when I was in Japan that first year on that College Women's Association of Japan scholarship in the Inter-University Center studying language in Yokohama, that someone hooked me up with Ono Kazuo, the Butoh dancer, his workshops. And he was giving these workshops up in the hills of Yokohama, where he would just kind of stand up and do a kind of like talk, jazz talk for maybe 10 or 15 minutes. Like I call it jazz talk, but he would just kind of talk a poem and he would just say things. And for me, so that happened to me that I started going to these weekly workshops very early in my time learning language. So I didn't really know Japanese yet, but there was sort of this moment that clicked where I'd taken it for 2.5 years, but I wasn't quite fluent yet. And I need to know what he's saying. I need to know every word. I need to understand every word of this amazing sort of impromptu poem thing. And there was a guy there that actually was the translator, a really nice guy, who every like 5 minutes would say one sentence of translation. And so I started to take over and be the tsuyaku, the sort of simultaneous interpreter for Ono Kazuo in the workshops. But he didn't actually let anyone just watch. You had to dance. So I started also dancing Butoh at that time. And so that was actually sort of the spark, that and sort of moving outward from that, of really wanting to know, well, when did Butoh start and what, you know, what happened else in the 60s? And I started to meet this group of artists who were all, you know, this time was in the 80s, late 80s at this time. But I was meeting all these people who traced the origins of their amazing and often very private artistic practices. You know, people who on the outside just had like sponsors or were freelancers doing some kind of nice thing in the bubble era to support themselves, but at home had these amazing artworks and were doing these whole amazing, you know, practices, art practices. And so that those were the people that started my interest in this period. Like, when did you get the idea to do this? How did you, what social formation created the idea of like being an artist in this particular way? Who did you read? And so everyone was super generous giving me things to read, and, you know, Bijut Techo from that time and from more recently, and, you know, introducing me to a whole new world of French literature that I wasn't familiar with from my studies of French literature outside of Japan. But the ones, you know, people like René Char, who were people in America. And anyway, so that's a very long story to say that even my first book was actually, I was already interested in the 60s at that time. And when I went back to Yale to study for graduate school after my time in Japan, it seemed like I should try to find out even further back what kind of history of the avant-gardes existed, who, where did it all come from even earlier. And there was also a certain feeling in sort of East Coast academia that the 60s was a little too recent to work on, and that it was better to work on the early 20th century if you were going to be sort of a respectable literature scholar. And you should know things from before. So there's not like a coercive push, but just like a sense that that would be more appreciated. And so I chose to go earlier at that time. Now the 60s seems like a really long time ago, but, you know, I guess in the 80s, it wasn't a very long time ago, in the 90s. So that was, so I was going back tracing these avant-garde and surrealist poets whose work was so important even in the 60s. So even in my first book, I kind of look back and forth between those two times. But I knew when I was finishing that book that I needed to move into the 60s and see what happened with bodies and performance. And so it was already kind of inherent in that project in a certain way.
That's so interesting. And it also, it's really interesting because you mentioned jazz earlier, and that'll actually come into the story later on in the book in a kind of tangential way when looking at some of the films. So I think this is, it's really interesting to hear how this is all really very much part of an organic whole, it seems, in terms of your interests. So great. Thank you very much. Now, the book itself, this is a good time to get into the book itself. It looks at moments in the arts in Japan, and moments is a very deliberate term. So I'll ask you a little bit about that as we get into this. But moments in the arts in Japan from the 60s to the early 80s, and really focusing on the 60s and 70s for the majority of the treatment. Now, it moves through from works of experimental theater to film, video, butoh dance, as you just mentioned, and finally photography, but also looks along the way at other kinds of media, so poems and essays and other forms of text. Now, this is it's a fascinating piece of text and piece of literature and analytic study that really is trying, as I read this, and I think very successfully managing to not hold these kinds of boundaries of form or boundaries of discipline stable in looking at larger phenomena and larger sort of emergences within a cultural moment. So it's, I think it was fascinating in that respect. Okay, so here is where I'm going to ask you to start sort of developing background here. Now, the temporal frame of the book pivots on a distinction that may not be familiar to listeners or to readers who don't have a background in Japanese history, and that's a distinction drawn between Shingeki and post-Shingeki theater. So in order to kind of set the foundation for looking at what this period of post-Shingeki theater looks like, can you talk a little bit for our listeners about these concepts? What is Shingeki theater and post-Shingeki theater, and what's kind of the major difference between the two?
Okay, so Shingeki literally means new theater. Shin is new and Geki theater. And that term was used, so it's already framing itself as a new form of theater that in itself was avant-garde in its time, like in the 20s when the Tsukiji Little Theater was founded. And people in Japan started to depart from conventions of shimpa, the kind of melodramatic traditional plays, or kabuki, or all the forms of more traditional theater that had been central to Japanese theatrical tradition up to that point, also rakugo, and began to do things like Ibsen and Chekhov, translating plays from the West and doing it in a style that was very much Western-y style, like without full face mask makeup, but more sort of natural makeup, also very much sitting on chairs and drinking tea from Western cups, doing things that you would do in those plays. And at the same time, there was also there was a movement in film in parallel trying to develop an indigenous or a local Japanese filmmaking tradition that would stand up to what was going on in the West, and a local indigenous theatrical playwriting tradition that would. So there was sort of a let's make Japanese theater, you know, as good as Western theater. Let's write our own plays. And so there were all these new plays being written in that style with dialogue, you know, based on a script. And there were also many avant-garde types of things, sort of more constructivist works being done, or mixes of the two were being done in the earlier 20th century. But by the time we reach the post-war, those forms have come to seem to the youth quite heavily institutionalized, quite conventionalized. Shingeki doesn't sound like a new kind of theater to them anymore. It sounds like old theater. It sounds like realist acting with feelings that are expressed, you know, that are kind of Stanislavskian acting techniques and things like that, which are very well developed. There are these amazing actresses and stuff like that. So, but very institutionalized, very kind of bourgeois. So young people in colleges, like at Waseda or others, started to want to do something different with theater. They had started to hear about Genet. They started to hear about Beckett and get those things translated. And there was a sense that they needed to rebel against those structures of quote unquote psychological realism. So to them, Shingeki meant psychological realism in some form. And they wanted it to go maybe back is the wrong word, but to re-inhabit the idea of a presentational, spectacular, embodied theater. So post-Shingeki is sort of the push away from that psychological realist Shingeki towards, crazy acrobatics and dialogues that almost make no sense and huge fragmentation. And there's still something going on that you could say has a psychological realism to it, that it captures the crazy fragmentation of the psyche. You know, that's realist in a different way, but they were just interested in creating something completely new, completely different, and sometimes also using more traditional scripts in a very different way, re-embodying them in a different way. So people like Suzuki Tadashi were very central to that. Betsy Yakuminoru, who was writing these incredible scripts at the time, Zoe is one of the first plays that kicks off that post-Shingeki movement at Waseda. And later, Terayama Shuji is someone who becomes really important to my writing about post-Shingeki, even though the late David Goodman, who's sort of the most prominent scholar on post-Shingeki, didn't really like Terayama. So he didn't really want, he's the one who actually coined the English term post-Shingeki, and he didn't really want to include Terayama in the canon of post-Shingeki. He liked post-Shingeki to be much more cleanly leftist theater, very, you know, like explicitly political, totally. Karajuro was good with him. Very explicit political theater. You know, Karajuro is someone who had Red Tent Theater in Shinjuku. And people, Oka Makoto is someone who really interested him. And David Goodman is someone who himself participated in these movements. He created a journal called Concern Theater Japan in English and Japanese, a bilingual journal in 69, 70, 71. At the time he was in Japan doing this stuff. Also, Carol Fisher Sorgenfrei should be mentioned because she was also in Japan around that time working with Terayama directly. And but anyway, so David Goodman didn't really want Terayama in that canon. But over the years, because I kept bringing up Terayama in my conference presentations and stuff, he gradually, reluctantly was willing to admit that Terayama was in a different way and always exceptionally also part of post-Shingeki.
And this is, for listeners, Terayama goes on to be really kind of the focus or a really central focus of the book in a really fascinating way. And having read this, I can't imagine not thinking of him in the context of post-Shingeki theater. Now, he's sort of this emblematic fish-biting amazing figure for me. Was that him or was that
you're right, that Terayama, I'm not sure I myself meant Terayama to be so central, but he has this really creepy quality in your psyche that the more you see him, the more you keep thinking about him. So,
And this is, you know, this is actually a great opportunity to get right to him. In fact, you mentioned that he's sort of creepy and ghostly. He actually begins in the introduction of the book by dying, or rather the report of him dying is something that begins explicitly the first sentence of the first paragraph of the introduction. Terayama is dying. This is really the end. And this is a quote from 1983 that you give us to open up this story. Because he's so central to the book and he's such a fascinating character, can you get us started here by talking a little bit about him? Who was he? Why was he so important to the story and what drew you to him in particular in the first place?
It's interesting to try to trace how I started to get interested in Terayama, because he does have this kind of quality of just being everywhere. When you start to look at these works, Terayama is interesting, and he may have been part of the inspiration of the cross-medial focus of my own research. You know, people like you have just so clearly noted how this work doesn't stick with just literature or just film or just photography. And if you describe who Terayama was, he was born in Aomori-ken, and there's actually a really nice Terayama museum there that I recommend people go to learn more about his work. But he came to Tokyo and worked in so many different forms. He started out as a poet, but he was working in somewhat traditional forms, but breaking. So he actually was connected with Kitazo no Katsue, the surrealist poet. He had a big enough ego that in high school he was already willing to write this very famous, very established surrealist poet, Kitazo no, in his VOW, his Vow magazine, and send a poem in and become part of the sort of in-group of that coterie magazine. And he was winning prizes and creating scandals. Were his poems too much plagiaristic because they were so intertextual, citational, or were they the radical newest thing ever? His work is so deeply imbricated with everything around him that it's like, wait, was he just kind of lifting this? Or and his autobiography is full of legends and sort of errors, and people are constantly trying to figure out what the real true story of Terayama was and which parts of his autobiographical writings were true and not true. But he wound up working in most significantly in theater, in experimental cinema, and also as a boxing critic. And he also made this postcard art and so many different fields you can find a little piece of Terayama, and also as a writer, writing essays, publishing books. So he had a really broad range across media and didn't seem to stand on that distinction, which is actually something that I noticed also in my artist friends that I met when I went to Tokyo way back when, that they tended to sort of do pictures and poetry and pottery and film, and it wasn't like, oh, you had to be trained in this to do it or something. It was like your vision was what was important, and you could bring it into all these different places. So
that's great. And just in describing him, a few of the things that you mentioned really struck me because they'll go on to become really central themes in different ways for the rest of the chapters. Just mentioning the importance of some idea of the authentic or a concern with an idea of the authentic, a practice of citation, which we'll see coming up later. And also the importance of a practice that integrates and an idea of fragments and fragmentariness. And you mentioned this also earlier, and this is also kind of implied in the notion of a moment that you're bringing up in the book and even in the title in the book itself. So I think in many ways, this is a great figure to open with, and this is really emblematic of many of the concerns that'll come up in different forms and in different sort of ways in the work of different people throughout the book.
Yeah. There's a whole, Kariyama has a way of pushing towards authenticity or asking for immediacy in his rhetoric. So he always wants everything to be a direct encounter and an immediate, you know, transformation. But his actual practice is so much more mediated, fragmented, repeated, intertextual, much more. So seeing the tension between those two things in Teriyama, I think, winds up becoming emblematic of what a lot of artists in this period were struggling with and working with rhetorically.
And conceptual
stuff like that. The culture of the copy and, you know, what was happening. There were Xerox machines. You know, the whole idea of copiedness was incredibly fascinating. And what did it mean that photographs and art could be replicated in a particular way that wasn't so much in the concept of art before? That set of concerns was really important to art historians as well.
Mm-hmm. And this is also just personally coming from the field of history, which is my home discipline, and sort of the kind of conceptual concerns that I tend to think about tend to be in the practice of a historian. And all of these, or the imbrication of all of these concepts, the authentic practices of citation, the relationship of language and the possibilities of language for telling a story and for sort of constructing memory, working with fragments, and the kinds of texts also that for the scholar of these kinds of documents and or these kinds of moments, and we'll get to that in a minute, come out of these sorts of performances. This is all, I think, really fascinating also to think about in the context of the kind of work that a historian does. And so I think this is really conceptually opening for people who sort of practice the craft of history as well. So that's just as a side note, I really got a lot out of this for that reason. Now, this introduction in the chapter introduces Teriyama, introduces his troupe, talks about the importance of the idea of an encounter, which also will be important later on. And also situates this within a broader context of the 1960s. Now, very briefly, because you mentioned that previous work on this kind of set of actors, or if not the same actors, then experimental arts and experimental theater in this period has focused on the importance of the political. And in different ways, an engagement with or refusal to explicitly identify with a political agenda or political agency comes up in this period throughout the works that you look at. Can you very briefly, if this is a reasonable request, and it may not be, situate what's happening for Teriyama and his troupe within sort of the wider political and social sphere of the 60s? You mentioned 60s protests and things. Are there any really important aspects of this social, cultural, political sphere that readers sort of would benefit from knowing about in order to understand how to situate this within that larger social political context?
Yeah. So I guess usually people talk about the 1960 protest against the Japan-U.S. Security Treaty as a really crucial formative moment, and it probably influenced me as well in choosing that as my starting point. Because the truth is that in my previous book, I mentioned Jiken Kobo, the experimental workshop of the late 50s. And so you already could talk about the rise of a lot of intermedial and experimental artworks in the late 50s. And you would, no one would protest and say you started too early or something like that. But for me, because of that particular moment of 1960, and that so many, also the Sogetsu Art Center had already begun its activities in the late 50s. And by 1960, the moment of the sort of most famous or among the largest protests against the Japan-U.S. Security Treaty, there was no one who could avoid doing something about that, either saying that it was futile and that it was pointless, or critiquing the way in which the different factions were not cohering well enough, or jumping in and saying, this is what we need. We need direct action. So the whole idea of direct action, which is so important throughout the 60s in the arts in America and in Japan and in Europe, is intimately linked in its as an idea with the idea that there are these protests and there are these students taking to the streets and getting their bodies hurt, you know, and you see on TV, and also not to mention the role of the media and TV and sort of making the consciousness of these things really available to many, many people. So, you know, just seeing people bash down the doors of the Diet building and, you know, hearing about injuries and hearing about then memorializing events. And you, I think that although Terayama himself was mostly disengaged from the actual protests, and he really protested against a good guy, bad guy, kind of cops and robbers narrative, that narrative seemed wrong to him. And that, you know, if you just claim you're a good guy and they're, the police are the bad guy, then you don't understand that you've internalized these incredibly powerful structures of domination in your own psyche, and that you're actually obeying, even by disobeying, you're within a very oversimplified narrative that needs to be questioned and needs to be delved into on the level of sexuality, on the level of family, on the level saying, like, I love my mother and father and I'm loyal to them to the end, but I hate, you know, the police. There, that's too simple for him. And plus he was very sick, so he was in the hospital quite a lot and was unable to participate in some of these things as well at times. So that particular note came from a time when he was in the hospital while protests were taking place. So going up through the 60s, people usually speak about the high growth economics in Japan. So that up going up through the 60s, by the time 1964 is the Olympics in Japan. So there's this huge push to clean up Tokyo and clean up the streets and kind of make Japan presentable to the West. And that's something that comes up very often in artists' works, that they're in some ways making fun of this kind of sanitizing impulse, that or just kind of noticing the shame and the dark side of what is implied by the need to constantly clean up things and rebuild. And many of the avant-garde artists are actually interested in the dark and the dirty and the smelly and all the things that are trying to be shoved aside in the preparation for a 1964 Olympics. And then as you go up through the 60s in this kind of incredibly schematic here, and you're a historian, so you could in every month something different that happened. But you know, going in 68, 69 and up through that time, there's an incredible emphasis on technological development, on economic development in Japan, so that Japan's growth, economic growth, is one of the highest in the world at that time. And so you could say that thanks to that prosperity, there is some extra slack created for things like art, and for people to live as artists. They have enough food. They, you know, that there's wiggle room in the world for people to come and see plays and support the arts. And so that's kind of a nice aspect of it. And something that I noticed also very much in the bubble period when I was there, because it was in some ways paralleled that kind of sense of, whoa, you know, artists, lots of bills in their pockets. That's a lot of bills for an artist to carry around, you know. So, and that allows a certain amount of freedom and a certain amount of leeway to create art. And at the same time, I wouldn't want, probably in my book, I didn't emphasize enough how fluid the boundaries are between commercial studio productions and these avant-garde underground productions. There's actually quite a lot of movement of every artist between the kind of studio or publisher run or corporate connected art forms and which they are using to support themselves, and the sort of underground stuff, which is also probably supported in most cases, like if you think of Sogetsu Art Center, you know, supported by Teshigahara's father, Teshigahara Sofu, you know, because of his empire, his son is able to launch this incredible art venue. So there's a lot of fluidity, a lot of the illustrators and a lot of the artists and a lot, all the photographers in the photography section are struggling with what it means that the mass media exists, that they are part of the mass media apparatus in their photography, commercial photography practices of some kind, even journalistic photography practices, and yet they want to do the anonymous photograph. They want to make a photograph that it doesn't matter who took it and nobody paid for it, and it just, I don't know, somehow captures a fragment of something. So they're struggling with that very fluidity of boundary between their own imbrication in that high commercial capitalism and the art practices that they claim are disconnected from it and are in protest against it and are trying to critique it. But there's quite a bit of movement between the two.
And the bringing up the fluidity of boundaries brings us, I think, very nicely into the next part of the book, and the first chapter, which looks at one of the works and one of the figures that you mentioned briefly before. This is Betsuyaku Minoru and his play Zo, which is from 1962 and which launched or is said to have launched the post-Shingeki movement. This is a fascinating account. This is a fascinating seeming play, which I've never had the benefit of seeing, but I'm completely want to learn everything about now after having read this chapter. Can you speak a little bit to this figure and to this play in particular and why it's so important for the themes that you're writing about in the book for listeners who may not yet have had a chance to read the book?
Betsuyaku Minoru, to me, and what people sometimes gets called, and this is probably an oversimplification, the Japanese Beckett, because his scripts are so interested in language itself, in the density of language, in the movement and flow of dialogue. And so he was a Waseda student right around the same time that the famous director Suzuki Tadashi was also a Waseda student. So they were working together, although Betsuyaku dropped out. But he, so as a student, as a college student, and college students can take heart that your college plays can go down later, in special circumstances at least, that they worked together. And so he was part of this group that was working at the what called the Waseda Shoujo. It was called the Waseda Theater and then became the Waseda Little Theater. And for me, Betsuyaku is a fascinating figure who describes his own practice of writing. I met him at a department store one time and I got to interview him about it. He still had that quality, who kind of floats through the city, and his ears are open to the fragments of dialogue that are coming from whoever is talking around him, and that's how he would write. Would be to go to a cafe and just sort of. He didn't want the play to be about subject people with personalities that clash in a regular conflict, and he felt. So to me, it's interesting that at the very origin of the post-Shingeki movement, we're already in a space where the idea of asserting yourself is kind of already in question. It's not like we start out with characters that assert themselves and then we reach doubt in the 70s. That's the narrative of the 60s is in the 60s, everybody knew what they were doing. We knew what was bad. We were protesting it. And then in 1970, everyone lost heart in the when the Japan-U.S. Security Treaty was renewed yet again after more protests in the Vietnam War and blah, blah, blah. So the usually people end like Tom Stevens' book in 1970, Osaka Expo, big moment of sellout and co-optation. But there's this huge ambivalence about sellout and co-optation and what is really worth doing anyway, and how do we know which direction to go in, is already so deeply in Betsyaku's formative plays of the early 60s. And so that's something that I wanted to really take notice of, and particularly in Zoe, where it's about the aftermath of the atomic bombing. And the character, the main character, is an invalid who's affected by, he's a hibakusha, a victim of radiation, who's affected by atomic bomb disease, and he's in the hospital. And so it's very explicitly has historical quality, but it also, and he wants to show their witness, but the play itself frames him and his nephew as his nephew doubting that this is at all possible, and himself also doubting maybe he isn't up to the task of conveying what really happened. So maybe that connects for me to the sort of original formulation of the book about memory and its expression, or the passing down through the generations, trying to express historically from one generation to another, and what is expressible, or what to try to express and explain in the present, what the past means, and how the next generation never quite takes it right. Maybe you're just showing off or something.
Now, this actually, mentioning his working habits, and you mentioned later in the book that fact of him actually sitting in cafes and incorporating chance conversations that he overhears into his scripts, this raises for me one of the really fascinating aspects of this kind of work, which is the textual inscriptions that come out of these kinds of performances. So in the next chapter, you talk more about Terayama's performances, and so much of this kind of experimental theater was bound up with the embracing of spontaneity, of sort of bringing non-planned audience elements into the actual performance and the actual happening or encounter. This raises, at least from the perspective of a reader, really interesting kinds of questions and ways of thinking about what it means to study this from the perspective of a scholar in the 21st century now. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about the nature of the scripts of these performances as texts that you study to get a sense of what happened in these performances. And so can you speak a little bit to that process for you? How does the nature of this source material and its relation to this kind of ephemerality of this performance shape the kind of story that you're telling here? And what is it like to both access and also work with these kinds of inscriptions to create this story of ephemeral performance?
And it speaks to the kind of materiality of the, which think about.
I think if you just let that hang, it might be the microphone might work a little bit better.
Yes. Anyway, that's a great question, because what we're left with are really accounts, you know, textual accounts of either newspaper reviews or critical writings about these performances, or in some cases, and the cases where I do a closer textual reading, there will be a video that was taken at one particular performance, and I'll tend to use that as, but knowing that actually it was reiterated multiple times, and each time would be different. There's even in certain cases with Terayama video as the script, like case of 100 Years of Solitude, Hyakunen no Kodoku, there's a video with a book. The script book actually completely perfectly matched the video. Like it was taken maybe from a very slightly different version. There was some direct interaction with artists and artists' relatives that was required of me in order to obtain sometimes pirated materials that I could work on. Or material that's very rarely in circulation, there is a difficulty for me around telling the stories, because I am very much trained in textual reading and close reading and kind of hermeneutic reading, where we take the object, you know, the work, as a kind of a text to look at. There certain benefits in trying to understand the philosophical ramifications of what's going on at a deep level and not just skimming over the surface with the pieces that would have been common in every performance. So I tend to delve into actual dialogues that are written down after the fact from often improvised performances, but the improvised performance, sometimes there would also be improvisation very on the level of the text. So the authorship is not so much Terayama as his troupe who are making up some of these words. And so that is posed difficulty, and I try to be sensitive to that, both on the level of production, that the production would change and shift from time to time. And I have a lot of notes that you may or may not have noticed where I'm saying, like, in New York, like this, Amsterdam, it was like that, and I'm working on the Tokyo version or something. And if you want to hear more about the Amsterdam version, read Steve Ridgely. And if you want to hear about the New York version, read Carol Sorgenfrey. And so it's kind of curious that we have multiple people working on multiple versions of it, in which the story comes out slightly differently in Terayama, like in the story Mink Marie, Kegawa no Mari. But so for me, I need to balance that. So on the level of production, the fact that there were improvisations, but still wanting to take seriously the sort of close reading of the version that I'm working on. And then at the same time, realizing that at the level of reception, often being like 100 years of solitude, there are these five stages, and a real human, regular, normal audience member wouldn't actually be able to absorb all the stuff that's going on at the same time. Sometimes it's sequential and it would take turns, but sometimes there would be things happening simultaneously or too far away for you to really see. And that circus-like quality was something that Terayama was very much going for as a philosophical expression of his point of view about experience itself, that there's always sort of too much going on for any one individual to grasp. The only way to grasp all is to pull together the collective memories of all the people, which you can sort of never do, even though it'd be
right. And that actually, that presents a really fascinating kind of problem for the person trying to study this, because when the very nature of the product is meant to be fragmentary, right? When it's sort of embedded in the very nature of the performance that no single audience member should or is going to be able to experience the whole work as a totality. And in fact, the whole work, what that even looks like, means something different depending on where you're sitting. Then how do you, from our perspective now, write about this in the spirit that actually kind of preserves that or takes that seriously, but also gives an account of it for a reader who wants to know the whole story, right? So it's fascinating to think about this from the perspective of methodology and the perspective of our positionality with respect to these texts. So
a little perverse in a certain way to go so slowly and so carefully on something that was so improvised, so quick, so and so full of accident, you know, that like when I interviewed the Butoh dancer Tamano Koichi, when I was doing my writing on the other Butoh dancer who he worked with as a disciple, Hijikata Tatsumi, I was reading these writings that are now published in a Zenshu, and Tamano was like, he was just fooling around. I know, what do you think of this word? He was probably drunk. I don't know. Like, I don't think you have to worry about that.
There's a ton of material for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book, or even for people who have. There's a ton of material in these early chapters in this first part of the book that goes into much more detail about these plays, about experimental performance, about Terayama. But in the spirit of sort of moving to some of the later material in the limited time that we have left, let's actually move to Butoh dance for a moment. This is actually, this marks part of a series of studies in part three of the book. So part two of the book is a kind of theoretical interlude that looks at theories of encounter. And these are theories of encounter that span some of the people we've been talking about, some others that also bring in some of the theoretical interlocutors like Benjamin, who is so central to the way the actors here, and I mean sort of historical actors, not just literal actors, are thinking about issues of encounter and embodiment and crime and contagion and all kinds of other things. So after that, we get to part three, which looks at experimental film, photography, Buteau dance, and other kinds of writings in a way that interrogates or that looks at how all of these different media kind of work together to interrogate notions, among other things, of home, of origin, of return. Okay, so Buteau features in one of the chapters in this section. And so since you mentioned it, let's talk a little bit about that. First of all, what is Buteau? For listeners who may not know anything about this, can you talk a little bit about Buteau and why it's so central to this set of issues that you're grappling with in the book?
The form of experiential dance. Sometimes people trace the origins of it to Ono Kazuo, the dancer who I studied with, and Hijikata Tatsumi, who had already died by the time I arrived in Japan. Their collaborations, as well as Ono, who was much older, his son, Ono Yoshito, who's still practicing Buteau today. And then there were several generations of Buteau dance. There's some scholarship by Susan Klein a long time ago, all the way through Bruce Baird, more recently writing a whole book on Hijikata, and trying to trace the history of people usually talk about Wigman and the German expressionist dancer and her influence on Japanese modern dance techniques. So some of like Hijikata and Ono were trained in Western dance styles, but then they were innovating this much more improvisational, much more messy style of dance that involved in, looking into violence, looking into sort of the dark underside of bodily excretions and things like that. And so in late 1959 is usually sort of posited as the origin of so. There are multiple generations of Buteau dance, so most might have Sanjuku, the group that paints themselves all in white. These days, when people think of Buteau, they think of people whose heads are shaved and whose bodies are painted all in white and who are moving very, very slowly on stage in a very aesthetically beautiful manner, and maybe from the ceiling, beautiful, organized and well produced light from the side, maybe pink. But Buteau that I'm talking about from this period is much messier, much sort of looser in its choreography. And at the same time, I look at writing Hijikata all through his life, which he also has these wonderful Buteau notebooks, which some of which are now available in sort of reproduction to purchase, where he would stick paintings and write scribbles next to it and kind of make these little collages that were the generative source of some of the ideas for the dance. So to me, this dance is also deeply textual. And I totally can understand that people would want to study it mainly as a bodily movement form. But what I'm doing is a little bit different in this chapter, which is studying the right around Buteau, the sort of ideas of dance and bodies that come out through Hijikata's writings, which to me are kind of like a linguistic dance and a textual dance or a poem, kind of like the ones that I was talking about with Kazuo Ono. When he would stand up, he would generate the dance straight out of a bunch of talking and moving and talking, and moving and bodies talking was just all of a piece. It all went together. And so today, when you watch a Buteau performance, you might have no idea what's going on, what the people are doing. But a lot of times, if you go to the rehearsal, I've done sometimes translations for rehearsal, and they'll say, okay, now the cats are waving at the moon. And You're like, oh, I have something else. That's interesting. And that the blue light has to come on at a certain moment. And so there'll always be like this kind of architectonics of language and metaphoric imagery that dance is built around.
And that actually sounds, the idea of bringing up an architectonics of imagery and the relationship of this kind of movement to a textual form of some sort also brings in the other two chapters in this section. And I know we don't have a whole lot of time to talk about this, but there are, for listeners, there are two really beautiful chapters that bookend this. One looks at experimental film, two films from the 1960s and one from later in the 60s, that trace post-war representations of the A-bomb, but trace it in ways that really explicitly move away from a kind of explicit visual representation that fetishizes the image of the mushroom cloud. And another chapter that looks at photographic experiments in a particular journal called Provoke, again, late 1960s, early 1970s, again, as a way of playing with different modes of figuration, and not necessarily sort of explicitly clear figuration of objects, of bodies, of sort of ways of representing landscape. And all of these three chapters together are working to sort of build this polymedia picture of artists at this particular moment or performers at this particular moment who are concerned with very common themes, right? Or themes in common, perhaps not common themes. And these are themes of homecoming, of return, of origins. So as we, before we wrap up and I ask you a little bit about what comes next, can you speak a little bit to this theme? And you can feel free to bring in whatever your most favorite works maybe that you mentioned in this section or that immediately come to mind in talking about that.
Okay. To talk about the theme of homecoming or return, it's very easy to be misunderstood because when people even use the word return, they think of something like the return to Japan, Nihonei no Kaiki. Really scary. You know, any kind of notion of home, notion of origins brings up a long history of nationalist engagement with, we have to go back to the true spirit of Japan, you know, crazy. And so I always need to sort of be very careful in even using those words to outline how for these artists, the word or the idea of return or origin is always present, comes out, but it's always kind of pushed that we don't have to return to authentic past as it really was. There's never a possibility of getting back to that. It really was, but that we're still inventing and we're creating and we're using the idea as a generative movement for something that ultimately comes out. So I always think of Kata's line about the origin is something that secretes itself. So you're like your skin sweating or something, that there's origin is not something you go back to, but origin is something that comes out without your actual control. It comes out of your pores or your nose or something even yuckier, kind of squeezes itself out, kind of dark, yuck, and is present, but is not in any way about, is not only about the past, but is actually a movement toward the future. And so those kind of images are, you know, clearly we have structures like the emperor system, you know, that are turn to origin in this very straightforward way. So to my mind, these artists are aware of those kinds of uses of the idea of return, and they're taking them and they're doing something completely twisted and perverse with them that makes it like very comfortable for some readers to find out. So I like that. And for me also, there's, you know, the idea in photography of indexicality of like that a photograph being in what way exactly connected to the reality, the thing that's photographed. And by provoke photographers swishing the camera, or but not as technique quite yet. Eventually, it becomes sort of framed as a style or technique that can be co-opted by the art market. But you know, blur, out of focus, and swishing movement of the camera, and the body photographer being somehow implicated are ways of decentralizing and destabilizing the relation between the photograph and the world that's being photographed, that is not to capture something of the real, but the real in this sort of ungraspable form.
Great. Thank you. And for listeners who might be also interested in theories of materiality or ideas of materiality, ways of engaging objects in this period, there's also some really interesting material in these chapters that looks at sort of notions of these chapters, and also the theoretical chapter right before this in part two, that looks, especially part two, actually, that looks at ideas of thinking about the body's engagement with things and objects, and how to sort of how those ideas were played with among artists and theoreticians in this period. So I'll just sort of put a plug for that, because it may not be obvious to readers who pick up the book, oh, I can learn something about what people thought about materiality and object. And that's very much here. And it's a really stimulating part of the study. So, Miriam, there's a ton of material in here. It's a wonderful book, and there's a ton of stuff that we didn't have a chance to talk about in our hour. Is there anything in particular at any level of discussion or of thought that you'd like to mention for listeners who may not yet have had a chance to read the book and that we didn't necessarily have a chance to talk about?
Yes, one of the things that's been interesting for me since writing the book is how things I touch on seem to be gaining in prominence in Western museum culture. Like in the middle chapter about encounter, I focus a lot on the artist Li Ufan. And just recently, there was a huge exhibition, Li Ufan at the Guggenheim. And I talked about the movement Monoha, of things, you know, which for me has such deep philosophical understanding, both of materiality, thingness, and also of encounter. There's been some exhibitions like in Los Angeles, and a new book coming out about Monoha. And Provoke also had kind of a touring exhibition after I wrote this chapter. There's been a certain kind of recognition of how interesting these works are. And so since especially the Provoke chapter is one that was written sort of towards the end of the process of writing this book and leads more directly into my next projects. So there's, for example, in November, there will be an exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in New York called Tokyo, A New Avant-Garde, 1955 to 1970. I have been helping with that, works on the kind of intermedial quality of the experimental arts of this period. And that has a book coming out. And so I'm moving sort of in the direction of photography, intermedial technological experiments, and also cinema media studies kind of versions of these questions. And so I just want to mention that because those are some of the things that are coming up and coming up.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. Miriam, this has been a pleasure to talk with you. The book is wonderful. And as I mentioned, I think it's a kind of book that speaks across disciplines, and that a lot of people who may not think of themselves as working in or being inherently interested in the arts or in modern Japan will really get a lot out of. And so thank you so much for making the time to talk with us today about it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much, and we will see you next time.